I'm calling to order the House Elections Finance and Government Operations Committee. And Representative Acorn, boy. Acum.
Mr. Chair. I will have you know that the name Acum comes from Acum, England, and in Old English, it actually means acorn. So you were not far from it. And Mr. Chair, I did have a chance to take a look at the meeting minutes, and I move approval.
Thank you. Any discussion on the meeting minutes? And for, there was a query, and Representative Lawrence was the chief author on the one bill, but Representative, the author of the other bill presented for both. And so, all in favor of passing the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes passed, even with stern opposition. And with that, I'll be handing the gavel over to Representative McDonald, and I will go up front to present the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you're set to go, you can, for the record, state your name, and you may present your bill.
It's right here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dwayne Quam, and I would move House File 1800 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Public Safety Committee. And I do have an A2 to get the bill in the form that the author prefers.
Very good. Chair Quam moves House File 1800 be recommended to pass and be referred to Public Safety Committee. And he has the A, what number did you say?
A2
amendment. You may present that amendment.
Thank you. A2 has a little bit of clarifying. There have been some discussions with different groups, and one of the things we added is the a subdivision. Some of the language does not apply to towns fewer than 5,000 residents, and townships are also included in that 5,000 reference. But it's just a technical to the technical to straighten out and clarify a few items.
Very good. Members, any questions on the A2 amendment? If not, all in favor of adopting the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Amendment passed. Chair, now that you have your bill in the order, would you like to present your bill?
Thank you. Basically, what this is meant to be is sort of a technical and clarifying bill. Just about every election that I recall has had an occurrence of where some county, municipality, or polling location has had some difficulties or confusion about the election. And we've had too many court cases that have, popped up. And the idea is to try and get it more logical, straightforward, and understandable for everybody involved, so we don't have the confusion and someone accidentally not, abiding by our current election law. This has come from at least a dozen or more people that have been local election judges or have been part of a county or town. The people are running to set up and have to coordinate all the activities and make sure the machines are there, whether it, again, if it's a polling location at a township hall or at a city, at a school. There's a lot that needs to be done, and this is meant to clarify procedures and make sure that we have an orderly election. And that way, if we don't have all of these things popping up, we can maybe have a little bit more confidence. And that is the intent of the bill. It's got quite a few sections, so if any members wanted me to pull out some specific things, I can do that. And as in past bills, this is a point of where we can come up with ideas to improve. This is going to another committee. But it's the intent that matters. The details will be worked out by our body and the Senate. But the intent is to make it clear and easy to understand. So we remove the confusion that causes people to say, well, something went wrong by, bad intent, instead of it was just confusing. So I will wait for questions.
Very good, Chair Quam. We do have a testifier on the list, Ms. Nicole Freeman from the Government Relations Director, Officer of the State, Secretary of State. And as you come to the desk, we do have a question from one of our members, Representative A. Cum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a really quick question. You said things would be worked out in the House and in the Senate, and I'm seeing on the brief that there isn't a Senate author. Do you have a Senate author at this point?
Chair Quam.
Thank you. I've had discussions with several of the senators, Senator Curran, and so my understanding is that there would be soon a Senate author. Because of a little bit of a delay in how, we're a little bit behind in the House because of all the bills dropping, the revisers, and et cetera. So this was recently drafted and jacketed and dropped. So I'm anticipating that the Senate one will show up as a, and plus I think we're still waiting for Secretary of State has a similar technical bill waiting for that to be jacketed and dropped. And I apologize that things were a little bit farther behind than they normally would be at this point.
Representative Akam? Very good. Ms. Freeman, thank you. For the record, state, you know the routine. You may begin.
Thank you so much, Chair and Chair Quam. Nicole Freeman, the Office of the Secretary of State. So I'm here today to provide feedback on House File 1800. The provisions in the bill, I think, largely our office is in opposition to many of them. I do appreciate Representative Quam's note in offering that this might be a work in progress, right? And I think that that's important because I think that as I read through this bill, and I think as is reflected in the letters from MACO and LMC and AMC, I think this really needs the feedback from administrators and how this would actually play out. So I'm happy to hear that a lot of this feedback is coming from voters and election judges and people who have had a part in the process, and I think it's just missing another chunk of that feedback. And so as Representative Quam said, this bill is rather large, and so, which I understand because we'll have an admin bill too. But I think overall, we do have concerns with the administratability of the bill, largely for local jurisdictions. And we also have concerns around reducing election judge privacy in exposing their political party affiliation, as well as worrying about what that might do both to their privacy and their safety, but also what that might do with recruitment. The changes to the cast vote record are sort of in that same vein, and I think we continue to have concerns around voter privacy and their right to a secret ballot in putting out a full cast vote record along with ballot copies that could pose a situation where you can sort of create back an election and figure out who was where depending on, the vote count numbers and time or date that they might have voted. So that is also a concern. As the MACO letter highlights, we also support flexibility in how a local government could staff their absentee ballot board. We recognize that there's several tasks that do need to be completed by election judges of differing parties, but the ability to use staff for other activities as well as oversight and training is something that we feel like is really important to retain that flexibility. A few topics that are going to be covered that we also have in our administration bill, and so I think we're all thinking about this, you know, similar issues here. In section 2, we agree that updates should be made to the process around residential facility and their staff members vouching for residents. But after gathering feedback from local election administrators, I think that we would prefer to remove the requirement for those jurisdictions to provide a list at all, instead of requiring that, and instead require staff members to show proof of employment at that facility. Sections 11 and 12, I think we also will cover in our admin bill. Those sections relate to political party election judge lists, and I think a few different things. Our office is already recommending that counties, if they are short on election judges, reach back out to parties. Oftentimes it is one political party or another that they need a few more people to serve in a location. And so I think that contact is already happening. And I think the feedback from our election team was, you know, sort of putting us in the middle of that process might not be the right way to go about doing it. And that overall, based on the clarity that the court provided in a court ruling last year, that we do need to look at that section and provide some clarifications around how local jurisdictions interact with this list from the political parties when they're hiring election judges, particularly for ballot boards, because that hiring happens, you know, several months before Election Day. Another item is that relates to the retention of election materials. So I think our office's feeling is that, and our guidance out to local election administrators is that all of the pieces that are mentioned and specifically called out in this bill, those are pieces that are already need to be retained. Our administration bill does add language in 203B to specifically require that ballot envelopes be kept. But I think we can continue on that conversation about how to clarify what does election materials mean. And I think the last one in the section of things that you'll hear about later too is that our bill will also have language related to chain of custody plans. And I think that our bill language requires the creation of such a plan and sharing materials, sample materials that will be used for those ballot logs. And I think with this plan, I have a few clarifying questions of why does a notary need to sign a log? At what point does a notary need to sign a log? These logs are oftentimes, you know, kept in several different locations depending on the location of the ballots and things like that. And so I think that, you know, all jurisdictions that are touching ballots should need to follow a chain of custody plan. Looking forward to having further conversations about chain of custody. That's obviously a really important part. Our office is also not opposed to receiving data from the courts. I think we're always looking for, as I talked about on Monday, we are always looking for additional information on how to keep our voter records up to date. I think one thing that I would want to follow up with the courts on is what's their experience with this data and what does that, if someone reports that they're not a citizen to the courts, what does that mean? Are they showing any proof that they're not a citizen? What does that mean? What we've heard from other states is that this data is sometimes not reliable because people may falsely report they're not a citizen to try to get out of jury duty. And so I think I would want to learn a little bit more from the courts as to, like, what does this data look like so that we're not, you know, applying a challenge to someone who obviously shouldn't be lying to get out of jury duty, right? But we just want to learn a little bit more about that. I could continue on, but I think that I will stop there and just largely say I think we're happy to work with Representative Quam on several provisions and on other provisions. I think we'll probably come to a place of agreeing to disagree, but happy to talk further about the bill with member questions and answer anything that comes up. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. Representative Lee.
I'm first.
Yes. The best is the first.
Thank you. Flattered. So I guess this question is for the author or Ms. Freeman. I have a number of things I want to bring up, but I think I'm just going to start first with the election judges. I know Ms. Freeman mentioned some concerns about revealing their party. And so, I guess I'm curious about the motivation, because my understanding is that there are already challenges to recruiting election judges. And so I'm just worried about the effect of forcing people to disclose their parties, and that potentially that would deter people from wanting to volunteer even more at a time when we don't have people excited to be election judges.
Representative Chair Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, there have been multiple court cases of where the issue has been that the counties have not been utilizing the state law, which says each of the major parties can generate a list, which means people have volunteered to be identified by that party and be election judges. So that's where the information is coming from. It goes up to Secretary of State and then is dispersed back down to the counties. So these people have already, basically gone to a party unit and said, I am a member of your party. I wish to be an election judge. Please add me to the list, which goes to the Secretary of State and down. And there's been this problem with recruiting for ballot boards. There have been multiple court cases over several elections of which the counties didn't use the list, weren't obeying the law, and they got taken to court. And then they started to abide by the law by utilizing the people that were on the list provided by the parties, of which each of these individuals volunteered to the parties to be identified by association to the party to be on the list that goes through. So you understand that I don't think the people that already have gone through to be identified by a party are going to object to the fact that you would allow for the people that are working it to more easily follow the state law by having a person from each of the major parties partake of multiple activities. So I guess I'm confused by that, but when the chair has an opportunity to allow me to clarify a few points brought up by the testifier, let me know.
Very good. Thank you, Chair Quam. You may continue, Representative Lee.
Yes. Question for Ms. Freeman. I mean, my understanding is we already know the election judge's party affiliation. It's not publicly disclosed, but the bill before us would force that public disclosure. Is that correct, Ms. Freeman?
Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lee. Yes. So that information is something that is able to be disclosed, whether it's at a polling location or through the ballot board. I think the Chair Quam is right in the distinction of where those folks were being hired from, where the lawsuit that happened. There was party balance, and the court found this, right? There was party balance that was happening on those ballot boards already, but they weren't being hired from that election judge list, from the political parties. And so I guess I would say, I think it's the feedback that we've received from counties and locals as they're hiring election judges is, yes, some folks do choose to sign up through this list, but other folks do sign up and then declare a party for which they affiliate with, through other means, through their individual jurisdictions. So, yes, that information is available within the within the polling location, within the group of election judges to ensure party balance is happening. But under current law, it's not something that is publicly available.
Chair Quam, you'd like to respond to that?
Yeah, a couple points. One, that there have repeatedly, across multiple election cycles, where election judges have not been able to find out who is from the major parties. There's no one. In other words, the head election judge is told, you know, we're supposed to have a person from each of the major parties perform this duty or that duty, and they're not allowed to know. And they're the election judges participating at that polling location. And if we, you know, that has been a big issue. The testifier seemed to indicate that, oh, they already made in a court case, there have been multiple court cases, and the ones I'm familiar with, that there was a total lack of effort to try and have a balance. In fact, some of the counties in past elections entirely composed their election, the ballot boards, with employees of the county, which doesn't meet. And that's part of the reason why when lawsuits in those counties were called on it, that they then went through the correct procedure of appointing people from the lists. So, you know, maybe there's an obscure case somewhere, but the ones that I've been informed on, they weren't. In fact, the most recent one, they didn't even contact a single person from the list that came from the Secretary of State, which was originally generated and given to the Secretary of State. So, I think that there is plenty of repeated need to at least, you know, I would be fine with a compromise at the polling location. All the election judges would see, so they knew it was happening. But that has been not happening. It's sharing it all with multiple counties. So that's what generated this whole thing, is the lack of following election law. And even with the intent, there's been the appearance of totally avoiding the procedures that are in our laws. And that's why clarifying language in this bill would make it harder for someone to accidentally forget to abide by state election law.
Thank you, Chair Quam. Representative Lee, okay. Yeah, I think it's fair to say, Representative Quam, Chair Quam, that on a more parochial level, election judges are great patriots. They love our system. They're proud of the parties they serve, and they're proud to share that. So I think this provision in the bill, being our first provision, is important to follow state law, and I think you'd find few objections from those who volunteer at the booths. It takes a great person to volunteer on election day. They spend all day doing their duties, and they're proud of the affiliation that they come from. So I think putting the state statute is not an issue. We certainly can make it an issue, but Representative Quam, we've heard from election judges and from our counties and those who volunteer religiously on election day, and these are some of their grave concerns. That's just my editorial, so I get to do that as a chair. But we have Representative Davis has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Nicole Freeman, for being here today. In your testimony, you had brought up cast vote records, CVRs. Can you just quickly explain to the committee what those are?
Chair Quam.
Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Davis. Yeah, so cast vote records are something that some election ballot, election tabulation equipment can produce, and it is essentially a record of the each ballot that's processed through a tabulator and the votes that were recorded on that cast vote record. It also includes information like the time the ballot was read, the date, and some other information.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nicole Freeman, why did you bring that up in your testimony?
Ms. Freeman.
I brought it up in my testimony because in, I think it was 2020, I'm trying to remember if it was 23 or 24, our office clarified because cast vote records weren't something prior to, cast vote records weren't something that was available on software that was certified in Minnesota. It became something that was requested and something that counties, because the their ballot software changed or sort of was updated, was something that was available to them to even turn on, right? And so in 2023, we clarified in statute that certain parts of a cast vote record shouldn't be made public. Essentially, what you could do then, whether you were an election judge requesting this cast vote record or you were, you know, another individual, you could monitor based on the time that a ballot had gone through. If the full information on the cast vote record was disclosed, you could say, oh, Susie Miller was here at 10 on election day. You can look on the cast vote record, and there's her ballot going in at 10:05. And so I think that is one of the reasons that we worked on this language with other members and county administrators as well to be sure that whatever would be released would be protecting voter privacy as that information is released. Yeah.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Nicole Freeman. Is there any other way to protect the anonymity of when a CBR was cast?
Ms. Freeman.
I think, again, the reason that we removed those data fields was because we didn't, if there's another idea out there, I think we're open to hearing it. But I think that based on the feedback that we had heard and gathered, that was the way to ensure voter privacy.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who are you getting that feedback from, Nicole Freeman?
Ms. Freeman.
I'm trying to remember now 2 years ago and who we reached out to. I know that we were in contact with our with local election administrators as far as what their ballot equipment gave them and the information in those cast vote records. And I'm fairly certain we talked with some other states who also had a requirement that their may have had a requirement that their cast vote record was published or other things. I know we looked at what other states were doing too.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Nicole Freeman, thank you for that testimony. So the biggest issue that the Secretary of State's office had and that your feedback had was a timestamp on the CVR. Is that what I'm hearing?
Ms. Freeman.
I think that that's one of the parts, and I'm trying to find the language in here to remember what all was removed. I think the other piece would be the date and then also the method where the voter cast the ballot to, because again, with the accepted date of absentee ballots and with early vote records, those being public now too, you would have a date associated with it. You'd have the precinct that an individual lived in, right? And so I think, so there may be a few more components. I would need to look at it again a little more closely. But my recollection is it's sort of the time, the date, the method of voting and being able to put that together potentially.
Representative Davis.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Nicole Freeman, are you aware that you are able to redact or exclude that information from a CVR, hide it? Are you aware of that?
Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Davis. Yeah, that is why we included to remove this information. Like, that's why we specified in statute what could be public and what could not be public. And so I think that's where we're again, open to talking about cast vote records and what data is available. But I think that's why we specified what could be removed or not removed in statute to clarify what is redacted.
Representative Davis.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So it sounds like the Secretary of State's office is willing to work with us on making sure that the public has access continuing and moving forward in the future to CVRs. Is that correct?
Ms. Freeman.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that what the state law says is that these files are public if they are captured at all, right? And so I also think that I think our office would continue to feel that ballot images should remain protected as private data. But again, our office supported the language that was put in 2023. And so, and that overtly clarified what was public data from a cast vote record. Yeah.
Follow up, Representative Davis.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much. Nicole Freeman. So if the technology that we have can redact or hide the month that or the date and the time, what is the problem with releasing the images too, making that public data?
Ms. Freeman.
Help me understand.
I think that our office feels like keeping those ballot images private is important. And that is, there's sometimes handwriting on them and write-ins and things like that. And so that has just been, has long been the position of the office to keep those private. There's something that can be reviewed in a court contest, but that historically those have been private data to keep your ballot secret. Yep.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Nicole Freeman. Well, I know not a lot of people write in a candidate, though it does happen. Not very many people write in a candidate, and I'm sure these smart software companies could write in technology too, or write in software too, that there would be a way to redact actual handwriting as well. You see, in recent history, including on both sides of the aisle, whether it be that Russians stole an election or that there's just ongoing tomfoolery going on in our elections every couple of years, we need to restore voters' confidence in elections. And I think a great way to do that would to make those images public. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Freitag? Representative Freiberg? I'm sorry, I couldn't resist. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Chair McDougall.
Touche.
We'll all have new names.
Once again, I lost my train of thought. Okay, so I'm going to have some comments and questions about the legal last on my side. I was just wondering about the process we're following here. I know Nicole Freeman came up to speak about the bill and answer questions. I know we have letters in our packets from League of Minnesota Cities, Association of Minnesota Counties, MACO, League of Women Voters. I see some representatives of those organizations there. I don't know if they want to testify, but often, you know, a chair will just ask if there's anyone else in the room who wants to testify. I know we may have subsequently have questions for Ms. Freeman or other testifiers too, but we can always call them back up also. So just wondering if anyone else wanted to testify.
Representative Freiberg, I certainly will. I appreciate the reminder. Representative Quam, was there a question, Representative Freiberg, first, the process you said?
Yeah, just if you were going to ask if anyone else wanted to testify, that was it. And then, I would have some questions about the bill, but I can go last for myself.
Is there anyone else, interested parties, would like to testify at this point?
All right. Thank you.
Speak now or forever hold your peace.
Okay. Okay. Appreciate it.
No, good question, Representative Freiberg. Thank you. Next on the list is Representative Coulter.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did just briefly before, I have a series of questions here, but one quick process question. I do see that the bill amends Chapter 13, which we all know is the Data Practices Act, Will this bill be going, is the plan for this? I know Chair said that this will go to public safety next. Will this bill go to the Judiciary Committee as well at some point?
Representative Coulter, this, as you know, will go to public safety. It will be re-referred after we pass it here out of this committee, hopefully with your approval. And then at that point, it's up to the chairman there, should it go and which direction.
Okay. I guess I would just say, I mean, again, this is, I think it's even House rules that any bills that amend Chapter 13 are required to go through the Judiciary Committee. We don't have to make that motion here, but just sort of putting that on the radar for folks.
Representative Chair Quam, would you like to respond to that?
My intent after the Public Safety Committee, the amendments and stuff put forward, I would like to talk to Judiciary Chair and see what they might want to look at. The thought was there's a possibility of amendments in public safety that could affect different things. And so I think there's a definite probability, but I was waiting for the discussion with the basically when I see the amendments coming at the public safety, I would talk to the Judiciary Chair. These are the things current, what might change. Do you wish to hear the bill now, or do you want to see when it gets returned to our committee? You know, basically the flow. I don't want to pop there, and then if I come back to public safety, there is a chance of something changing and then going back to Judiciary. If we're going to repeat a stop, it would be this committee and not another one.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, yeah, like I said, I'm not going to make the motion. I just wanted to raise that for folks. I did also want to just sort of double back briefly to what Representative Lee was talking about. And, to your point, Mr. Chair, I don't doubt that most folks who do volunteer to be election judges, and having been on a city council, you always see the full list of folks who do it and know we have to approve them. I don't doubt that most folks who do choose to participate and choose to identify with a major party do so where, and they would not have a problem with that. But I also know from years of working on campaigns and knocking on doors that a lot of folks, even if they do identify with a party, don't like to say that they do. And so I think in this particular instance, and Chair Quam, you referenced a possible compromise that I think is worth exploring. I just think in this particular instance, by making it public data, we are requiring folks to disclose that, whether they want to or not. And I think that will inhibit recruiting election judges. And I think it, frankly, will just make a lot of folks deeply uncomfortable with the process. So I don't have a question there or anything. I just wanted to raise that. To the specific language in the bill, and I'm looking at line 4.33, or 4.32, rather, is where it starts. This would allow it would say a county administering elections may not require municipality or school district to use the electronic poll books. And that is really troubling to me because I think it creates, frankly, a situation where there is the potential for a lot of chaos. And I see it, I would say it's probably mostly on the school district side because school district boundaries are more likely to cross over counties. There are some cities that do that, not very many. But school districts cross counties, and so I think you have a situation where, a county may require a portion of a school district to use poll books, and then another county may not. And then the other side of that is you look at like a county like Hennepin County, where there are lots and lots of different school districts. And if a school district chooses to opt out of this, now suddenly, or multiple school districts even opt out of this, now suddenly one county is tasked with administering a hodgepodge of how elections are administered at the school district level. So that's really troubling to me, and I guess I'm just sort of curious for what the purpose of that language is.
Chair Quam.
Thank you. Part of it is there are school districts tend to have elections that aren't on the regular even year November
timeframe, because they'll have referendums and levy. There's multiple things that can happen. And I've been on a school board where we have been the ones administering the election because we were the only question on the ballot. And therefore, we had, you know, selected precincts, polling locations, did all this stuff, and then made sure that it was staffed and et cetera. The whole question about poll book versus the electronic, there are a lot of townships where they've got their election judges use the paper. In fact, I believe my last, I'm thinking that my city actually had the paper one, and I'm not sure if it was a recent election. I remember going through the book because I had seen it. There's two Duane Quams that are in the same precinct. Some people prefer the paper and the book, and we actually have held a large number of elections using those and not the electronic tablet. So this is allowing for some of those precincts, some of the schools, some of the entities, the choice of using the paper book instead of the electronic tablet. And that's just allowing the choice. It doesn't cause confusion about, who's in the school district, et cetera, because the school doesn't run an election in the general election. That's run by the normal process, the municipalities, the counties, the townships, et cetera, because it's only part of, one of the questions. The only time the school would be doing it on its own is during that levy or an off election, not that standard one. So I hope that clears up the confusion about schools.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did mostly focus on school districts, but it does also apply to municipalities. Mm-hmm. And I will also say, of course, that not, many school districts do odd year elections or off. I don't know what, there's no odd year. But anyway, well, there are lots of odd years, actually. But I guess my point is that if the concern is to, it does seem to me like it would create some confusion, some chaos, because you have different local entities, some using different processes for administering elections. And I just think that's a problematic piece there. Turning next to line 17.12, I made sure to write down the line number so I could get there quickly. I'm looking at, this relates to transmission of unofficial results to a central location. And I see here, the language in the bill deletes this language that says the head election judge may transmit the accumulated tally for each device to a central reporting location. So, this would remove that ability. So I guess my question is, what is the alternative here? Are folks going to have to take these transmitted results and drive them to the county courthouse every election day?
Rep. Chair Quam.
Okay, first I want to clarify on the previous question. They're doing the same process. One is using, and the people that are actually there locally performing the election are either using a paper book or a tablet. That's the tool. It's like if I, you're doing the same process, you got the same information. It's whether you're handier with the book that's written or a tablet. But getting onto this one here, the whole underlying change here is after the close of polls, the head election judge. It maintains that the same. It just clarifies that you cannot preliminarily take and print out, view, or access results before the end of the election. In other words, this to prevent someone from reviewing it and then sharing that to somewhere else. One of the examples was a head election judge, I think it was in 02, saw that there was a very close election, determined on their own that there were, I think it was 17 spoiled ballots, took those, burned them, went home, burned them in their fireplace, came back. That election was determined by, I think it was 4 or 6 votes. So more than twice the difference of the end result was in doubt because of an action that was taken because they had prior knowledge of how close it was, and then they performed an activity that caused the results to be in doubt. That did go to a court, and the judge determined that, you know, I'm not going to change the results because there probably were the same proportionality in those that were burned. Frankly, that didn't sit well with a lot of people. And this would prevent anyone from, before the end of the vote, to be looking at those results and then take away that possibility. And I can't remember the exact court case. It was in a Austin Senate race, I believe, 02.
Representative Coulter, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a conversation with someone not too long ago. That was when now former Senator Dan Sparks was elected the first time. I mean, I listened to the description that you just gave, and it feels like I'm reading from a different book entirely, because if you look at line 17.12 and 13, it already says after the close of polls, the head election judge must create a printed record of results of the election for that precinct. And then later you add language here, preliminary vote totals must not be whatever, prior to the closing of polls. So that, I mean, that this is already the case that this record can't be created until under law. I mean, if people violate the law, that's one thing. But it already says here that this record cannot be created until polls close. The language that you delete says that after the record has been printed, the head election judge in a precinct may transmit the accumulated tally for each device to a central reporting location. During the canvassing period, the results transmitted electronically must be considered unofficial until the canvassing board has performed a complete reconciliation. So, I mean, I asked a question and I didn't hear an answer. I mean, so it sounds to me like this would result in the election judge for every precinct then being unable to transmit these unofficial results to a central location. And that I don't understand why we would, I mean, that they wouldn't be able to transmit it electronically. And so it sounds to me like, you know, my election judge in Bloomington is going to have to take the results and drive them to downtown Minneapolis. And I don't understand the purpose of that.
Representative Coulter, is that a question?
It was probably more than two. We can move on. I don't need to belabor the point, but your description about burning ballots had nothing to do with the language that I was referring to.
Representative Coulter, I'm sure that I'm confident that Chair Quam will make it more clear because he wants to answer this question.
Sorry.
Chair Quam.
Subdivision 2, of which you're addressing the changes. In those changes, 17.19 through 17.21, it specifically is prohibiting the looking at, accessing, and et cetera before the end. So there's a clarification. It also has the last word, well, the last three words, is a felony. That's why it's going to public safety, because in the past, when something untoward happened, well, that wasn't right, but there wasn't a punishment for performing it. This is to make sure that if somebody does that, that they understand there will be punishment for the meddling in election in this type of activity. And that's why I brought out the example of a court case this century, because in this section, that language is added for the felony.
Representative Colch, do you want to move on to the next question?
Yeah, one last. We'll just move on from that, because I'm something's not clicking here for me. So I'm going to move on lower down on that page, and this was something that we just spoke to. And I'm actually wondering if is Ms. Freeman still here? Oh, she was hiding behind the pillar. I'm looking at line 17.27 and beyond. These are all things that are currently non-public data that, if this bill were to become law without being changed, would suddenly become public data. Data that indicate the date, time, and order in which a voter cast a ballot, the method in which that ballot was cast, data stored as images. So we're talking about images of ballots. Could you, Ms. Freeman, could you just speak to you got into this a little bit. Could you speak to the effect that these changes would have on voter privacy, on secret ballots?
Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Coulter. I guess to reiterate what I've said earlier, our office has concerns with being able to reconstruct an election and put back together the name of the person who, you know, cast the ballot with the time, the method that they might have cast that ballot, the location where they cast that ballot, be able to, again, to expose how someone might be voting. I know that there's these concerns have been raised in other states as well. I know Texas is one that's looking at, you know, did sort of the exposure of this information go too far, and what risks there are to voter privacy because of the way that you could potentially reconstruct that election and no longer have a secret ballot or have confidence that you're casting a secret ballot. I think one of the filling in a bubble with a pen is something, right, that is much more indistinguishable amongst folks. But if you are using an assistive voting device, the printing that happens, it's very obvious that it is printed, right? And that's okay. But I think, you know, for folks that are using these devices, sometimes it's, you know, a number of people in a precinct, other times it's just a handful. And so I think that situation in particular, as it relates to the ballot images, would be one example of how someone's voter privacy could be exposed.
Representative Coulter, a follow-up?
I'll be there. I think, you know, Ms. Freeman brought up assisted voting technology, which I had not even considered, but I remember from my days working on recounts that there are any number of what we could consider identifying marks when you're going through and counting ballots by hand. And so I heard Chair Quam indicate that the issue that he was trying to address and a willingness to focus on a solution that would address that issue potentially while reducing some of these concerns. So I'll take him at his word on that, but I wanted to just raise that up because I think that's a really problematic piece in the bill. Thank you.
We have Representative Altendorf, who is calling in. She's stuck in the snowstorm. And then on deck is Representative
Mr. Chair, quickly.
Mr. Chair, quickly.
The only thing, 17.32, if Representative Freiberg agrees I can do a oral amendment to undelete line 17.32 so the images are protected non-public data, so that the images would not be public data. Without that, there would be no way to reconstruct who they voted for. And that way, it's still available for data if there's a recount and there's a concern about something happening. But that way, because I don't know anyone that's ashamed that they've voted. Now, if there's a concern about preventing the where a person resides, and there are protections of which the Secretary of State's office is involved in making sure that that's protected, there's already a process to exclude location type data about a person under protection. And my interpretation is what precinct they're voting in would be location data. So Representative Freiberg would agree, we can do this technical amendment and undelete 17.32, which means that the actual images would not be, they'd be non-public data.
Representative Quam, would you like to hear Representative Freiberg with his, Representative Freiberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Quam. I mean, sure, I guess I'd be, you know, I think that would improve the bill. I don't think it would either make it to a point where people on our side are comfortable with this, everything. And that just regarding this specific issue of cast vote records, I do still think that there's a potential for a privacy concern related to date, time, order in which a ballot was cast. So, I mean, it's a step in the right direction. I guess I'd be willing to go along with the amendment for that reason. I don't think it would alleviate all of our concerns, however.
Mr. Gearing, would you repeat the oral amendment by Chair Quam?
Mr. Chair, sure. So the proposed oral amendment would be on page 17, line 17.32, reinstate the stricken language, that entire sentence there that reads, data stored as images are protected non-public data under section 13.02 is now stricken. So with this amendment, that will be reinstated.
Thank you, Mr. Gearing. So that is an amendment, oral amendment by Representative Quam. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Whoop. I'm sorry. I'm going to take the vote again. All in favor of the oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries.
Division.
Motion doesn't carry. Yep. Representative Vang calls for division.
Lee.
Lee,
there are
a lot of us
Hmong women in the legislature. I'm older than
Vang,
she is, though.
She's my co-chair and legacy.
Yeah.
People with German names get it, too.
Same with the Irish. Okay, those opposed, please raise your hand. Well, excuse me, gentlemen and ladies. We have a Zoom remote, so we can't.
We ask Ms. Offendorf.
Representative, let's see, what is the protocol on this? I seek advice from counsel.
I think you just count, right?
Yeah.
We'll take a roll call. Yeah. A roll call being called.
Okay.
Ms. Rainers, please take a roll call.
Chair Quam?
Aye.
Vice Chair Altendorf?
No.
Representative Akum?
Aye.
Representative Coulter?
Aye.
Representative Davis?
No.
Representative Gordon?
No.
Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Representative Lee?
Yes.
Representative McDonald?
No.
Representative Roach?
No.
Representative Vernig?
Yes.
Being six ayes and five nays, the motion is adopted. And the amendment. Next on the list, Oh, Representative Altendorf, do you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Chair McDonald. This was just a comment to Representative Coulter, really. So I had just been at the Ramsey County public accuracy test, and, you know, for his question about the data, they actually, and being one of the biggest counties, you know, in Minnesota, they physically bring their memory cards in. And so what we've seen is Ramsey County, other counties do that, and this is just, the purpose of it is to bring consistency so that we have the counties doing things the same way.
Thank you, Representative Altendorf, for that input and information. Next on the list of questions is Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the issue that I'm going to ask about or make a comment on has been talked about a lot. It's the election judge party affiliation piece. And I will just say that and actually, maybe Ms. Freeman can answer a question for me. Are there election places, or so? For example, when our city is looking for election judges, they hire them and administer. Since I'm new to elections, I'm new to some of this stuff. So you guys might know it all really well. I don't. So in Minnetonka, for example, where I live, if they need election judges, they put out something on in the newsletter, on the website, and they look to get people to apply. And it's not, I don't recall that that included a party affiliation, does it?
Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Akam. So what state law requires is that municipalities, whoever's hiring, the body that's hiring the election judges, they first need to go and attempt to contact these folks on the election judge list from the parties. But that's oftentimes not adequate. And so, yes, they will solicit other folks. An election judge is required to either affiliate with a political party or declare that they don't affiliate with a political party. So they will be asked that after. So they might apply, and that may not be on the initial application, but as they are processed in order to be hired, that question will be asked for them to affiliate. Do you affiliate with a party? And if not, they would be, you know, in a category saying they don't affiliate with the party. Yep.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and I appreciate that. And I think I would encourage that we not be asking for party affiliation. I mean, the reason I brought this up is that my son, while in high school, was an election judge, and I don't think at that time affiliated with a party, or, I mean, he was just trying to learn more about the process and be more involved. And so I appreciate the clarification about the process, but I think that this can be, to the point that's been made by many others, maybe a detractor from recruitment. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
The point being, there are activities election judges do. Some of those activities are stipulated in law, must be performed by two election judges from the different parties. So every election judge doesn't have to have a party affiliation listed or known, but there has to be the known to be able to pick a pair to do certain activities. That's if we actually want to follow and abide by our election law, and it's been pretty basic to our election law for longer than I have been alive.
Representative Akam.
Whoops, sorry. Thank you. And that makes me think also of, again, in our local community, our city council and school boards are nonpartisan elections, and so I guess, as you and I have spoken before about the impact of partisan policies on nonpartisan seats, I think I have some concern about that. I understand current law, so thank you for describing that.
Next on the list is Representative Vernig. And then Representative Freeman is on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Quam. Representative Coulter asked a lot of the questions that I had, you know, as a former school board member. So just so I understand, you know, school districts don't usually create their own rosters. And in my area, precincts don't necessarily align with school district boundaries. So the school districts in my area contract with the county to provide election services. Based on what I'm reading here, it looks like if districts, so I represent two districts, 196 and 197, and you could be in, you know, let's say precinct one, and part of that precinct is represented by 197 and 196. And let me tell you, that superintendent 197, he is a real tough one to work with. I'm teasing, he's really nice. But if he says, if that district decides to not use the electronic rosters and 196 does, how feasible is that for the county to be able to administer? It seems like this could be kind of a challenge.
Chair Quam.
Well, this would be at polling locations. And I believe, because I've seen a bill to try and combine across polling, that frankly, and I'm trying to remember the implication, I've got a location in my district that is in two different school districts. And I believe they have a roster so they know exactly who is in that school district. I don't think that would be a problem. In fact, I think it would be useful to have a separate one so that you know that if you're in this book, you get this ballot. If you're in this book, you get that ballot. And I would think that would make it much easier to make sure that you give them the right ballot.
Representative Verney?
Yeah, thank you. I will respectfully disagree. Personally, I think if one district says we want electronic format and another district says paper, I don't think it would be easier. That's just my opinion. Thank you for answering.
Very good. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to turn to an area we haven't covered yet, which is the challengers provision. And I just wanted to start by asking, and I think we're on 13.24. I know it's a big bill. I like big bills. So I appreciate that. I'm trying to understand the difference between the challenger that is in current law and the observer, like what you're trying to get at with this language and adding an additional person who is not administering the election into the mix.
Chair Quam.
Thank you. With the interaction with multiple people about issues that they've seen, the idea of having an observer who can, you know, look and make sure that things are being done is different than where the political party has a challenger and there are additional functions of which they can partake in. And they usually also have accessibility to contact a lawyer if they've got some questions about something happening. But the observer is, there are a lot of things going on during elections with absentee ballots and different things here and there, and that would allow for someone to observe what was going on for the record. And that's what people were asking for, is making sure there's an opportunity so someone can watch, you know, that they're opening the envelopes and they're doing all these things. And that was why this was added.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then I guess I have a few questions of in the law, it looks like most of it is just adding or observer to the statute, but who would choose, appoint, sort of vet the observers? I know there's a process in law for the challengers, but I'm wondering, it's not clear to me from the bill, so I'm wondering where I find that or what you're intending.
Chair Quam?
Oh, thank you. The intent is to allow for, and I'm also looking at the nonpartisan elections of where each nonpartisan candidate may appoint by written certificate. So it would be, it can come from a candidate. And it doesn't have to be a party. So if a candidate wishes to have an observer, and that's just a few lines below. So there are multiple entities that could do it. And many of us are more familiar with, you know, the BPOU chair or CD chair signs the permission slip and there's the affiliated. But it also has been and would continue to be nonpartisan elections of where a candidate could have the same, to have a observer present, so that would provide for fairness in observing.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, to me, and I have a few more just sort of substantive questions about the bill, but to me, this question, you know, I have been in my past life a quote-unquote challenger, and it really sort of functioned as an observer, the way that the law both structures you, you sort of stand back and you watch, right? And so I actually would have no problem changing the term of challengers to observers, because I think that's actually more accurate to what in current law a challenger does. I think my concern would be in this is adding an additional person there who I think is, and you cited, I think, the nonpartisan elections for challenger appointments, that also would apply to observers. The partisan elections for challenger appointments, that would also apply to observers. But an additional person so that would be, you know, up to 2, 4, 6, 8 potentially people in the mix. And part of the whole goal of this is, and I think you would agree, is we do not want, whether they're challengers or observers, to interfere with the administration election, to slow stuff down for people. Their job really is there to observe. And I know that, you know, some party challengers will have, like, the party, like, will have a number to call. You could imagine observer having that, too. But my concern is just adding another person, and I see that the language says a challenger or observer, and the role could be performed by the same person. The main big change is this on line that starts on line 14.2, which is permitting the observer, not the challenger, but the observer to observe, that's actually already happening, but to take photographs, videos of the activities so long as they're not further disseminated. I'm wondering if an observer is in the polling place and takes photos and videos of what's happening, somebody registering or ballots being counted or, you know, just the general what's happening in the polling place, Where is that data stored, and who has the ability to disseminate it after the polls close?
Chair Quam.
Thank you. If you've got some, you know, intent of language, and I would be very open to looking at that. That part of the whole thing was, over decades, it's been challenger, observer, and there's been a little bit of confusion exactly what's going on. And this sort of came from a lot of people really are wanting to make sure that there's somebody that observes what happens. That if a candidate, and a lot of times the city council and school board elections tend to be a little bit more energetic, shall we say, and that if you've got somebody that says, yeah, I watched and everything was fine, that's going to diffuse
the post-election discussion quite a bit. So I'm very open to clarifying language, and in fact, the if you get that ready for the next committee, because I do think that there needs to be an issue about data privacy in the voting process. So I think that that's something we should have a discussion on. But this mainly came from a lot of people like the word observer. And I'd like to diffuse all the, if you don't know what went on, you're guessing. But if you've got someone you trust that says, yes, they did everything appropriately, then you get rid of a lot of the angst.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that. I would fully, I think I've probably said that we probably talked about this on the floor, and I have not asked anybody, but changing the name of challenger to observer to me seems to be a better reflection of what those folks are actually doing. And from a voter's perspective, and frankly, an election judge's perspective, having someone in there who's, it's clear what their job is. To me, this provision is the photographs and video provision are really problematic. I'll sort of give a few examples because I think we've seen, I mean, now where everybody has a phone, ability to take photos and record. And we really try to protect the sanctity of, and I know that we have had these conversations before. I think we've had some bipartisan legislation in the last couple of years about protecting the sanctity of the polling place and the places where the ballots are being counted and cast and stored. And what we have seen with both cast vote records, what we have seen with clips that of people who have in many cases not in an authorized way in the last couple of years have taken videos and photos is without context, it is easy to both show and tell a story. We know, and we can hear from our county elections administrators, that the process of putting together in each step of the election is both complicated and belabored on purpose, right? We spend a lot of time disconnecting the ballot envelopes from the ballots to protect the secrecy of the ballot. We spend a lot of time doing redundant things, like counting in a couple different places with more than one people in order to protect the accuracy of that and to make sure that people have faith that it's not just one person counting, but it's a couple that come from different parties or their staff or whatever it is. But to me, one of the things, one of the real dangers we've seen as it relates to voters' confidence is the dissemination of photos, video, snippets of records that have led to, and in the wrong hands sometimes, been told a story of things that are not true. And even when it's not intentional, misinformation, it's or disinformation, it's misinformation, and people may interpret or may not know the full context. I know, because I've been talking to a lot of our election judges in the last 4 years, they've spent a lot of time welcoming voters in, bringing people into the process, showing them how it works. And what I have heard from them, the feedback I've got from them, is when they do that, when people come in and watch from step A to Z, they understand it better, and actually there's a lot more trust and faith. And I think one of the reasons we have the voter fund, one of the reasons we've been pushing to have more resources towards local elections administration is so that our local elections administrators can do things like this. But the idea of having cameras and videos and things being taken by folks who are standing right behind or near where voters are checking in and registering, right behind or near places where ballot envelopes potentially are being separated, right behind or near places where ballots are being counted or certified, or even showing how ballots are being stored, to me raises big both privacy concerns, security concerns, and an election integrity concern that we are frankly, in the middle of our election administrators are in the middle of trying to solve. And so I think that, to me, changing the name from challengers to observers fully would support, and we should work on the language. I would oppose and am really concerned about this idea of bringing photos and videos in and having people who may or may not know or respect the rules, but also after it appears in this language, after the election, the polling place is closed, they can disseminate it, just creates a bigger misinformation or misunderstanding problem, which the last thing I'll say, and this is why I have concerns how this relates to other parts of this bill, which is allowing and putting on display both election judges and their partisan affiliation. We know, and this committee has considered and heard and passed legislation to protect election workers from the rising fear threats. We've seen it everywhere. It's not a partisan issue. We hear Democratic election workers and Republican election workers and nonpartisan election workers say it, that in the last 4 years, they have felt that. It's why we're seeing, in some cases, people leaving. We should protect them. We have protect them in law from doxing. We have protect folks from the ability, with given them the ability to protect themselves in the law. And so the idea of bringing in more, whether it's cameras and actors who potentially could elevate that threat, to me is really concerning. And so if you're willing to take this piece out, I'd love to talk to you, but we can talk about language, but just I think it's very important to say that when we're talking about election integrity and we're talking about security and we're talking about safety, that bringing in and disseminating videos and camera unedited or edited that without context has been a huge problem. And I don't want to see us further exacerbate that by what I think is probably a good intentioned way of making sure we have observers in the polling place. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenman, you make some valid points. The intent of it is no different, really, of a security camera that's probably already in a public building. And this is not intended for observers to sit there and record on their phone. It's to prevent, as Representative Davis said, some tomfoolery, if you will. There, several years ago, we witnessed on video security cameras of ballots being drawn underneath a table by the boxes and boxes and counted. So this is just an opportunity for a voter, a observer, a poll watcher who has the dutifully, lawfully ability to be there to record something in so much as the fact, if needed, to use later. It's not to be disseminated and shared out or put anybody in danger. One could question, and maybe I could be corrected, but in a public space, I don't recall if there's laws disallowing someone in a public building or public space from using a phone to take a picture or a video. But the intent is to protect the integrity of the institution and the voting day for a lawful poll observer. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that there's two big differences. One, the language literally says observers must be permitted to observe activities at any location in the polling place where ballots are cast, handled, or counted, and take photographs and videos of these activities so long as the photographs and videos are not disseminated until after the polling place is closed. So what that means is not like a security camera, which I would actually, I mean, this is a fact question that our Secretary of State or maybe even our county folks can say, but I would be surprised if there are security cameras in places where there's balloting happening that are focused on voting, because I think that there's real ballot or security issues. But in that context, the security camera, one, we have not heard about it being disseminated, and two, it would be the footage would be and be held by whoever the public owner of the building is, not a random person who pulls it off or who has the party gives them the ability to pull it off the security camera. So the who stores and disseminates, I think, is really important. But more than that, the issue you raise is this language doesn't have any of the limiting things you said, and it allows dissemination just the one barrier, the one narrowing is until after the polling place is closed. It's not even clear to me in that language whether it means after the polling closes close to the night, which is how I think you would interpret it. So you could do this you know, days before, if you're early voting, and it could have an impact on the election. The other thing I will say is we do actually have laws that prohibit people from taking pictures of other people in a polling place. And that is because, again, back to the sanctity of you should be able to, as a voter, go in and vote and not feel like, one, someone's going to try to figure out who you're voting for, which we all believe in the secrecy of the ballot, or two, that you, frankly, you know, you could be in a situation where because of the religious affiliation you have, your spouse doesn't think you should vote, or you could be an 18-year-old in a family who has a, whatever it is, people shouldn't have to, people should be able to go vote and leave and that be their business. And I think we probably all agree on that, but introducing cameras, introducing photos, and then having those photos be the property of, if it's your cell phone or anything else, that person is a really big concern. And it is not the same thing as a security camera. But frankly, Chair, I would have a concern if people were, if there were security cameras in polling places that were then disseminating that footage. And so I know when we were talking about ballot, there was a long conversation. I was on the conference committee in 2021 about drop boxes and photos or video recordings of drop boxes for security reasons. And I think we all, in theory, were okay with that. There were some voter integrity or voter privacy concerns. But the other question was, how long do you store it? And how does it take? I think, you know, 2 years, 2 months. But that's, those were really intense conversations we had about how do you store it? How much is public? How do you disseminate it? How do you protect voter privacy? And to me, none of that is implicated here. I would say it's just as easy to say, if you are a private person, you should not record or take photographs in the polling place. But that's where I stand.
Next on the list, we have, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question for the MACO folks, so I don't know if they're here in person. Okay, so while he's getting up there, I will bring us back to Section 23, page 17. I think Rep. Altendorf was trying to help us out with what Rep. Coulter was asking about this transmission of data. And so there was mentioned that, you know, Ramsey County drives over their memory card, but that's not possible for folks in, like, St. Louis County. And so I'm just wondering if maybe our MACO friends can help explain, you know, how this information is transmitted.
Very good. State your name for the record, and you may proceed with your answering Representative Lee's question.
Hi, my name is Troy Olson. I'm from Ewald Consulting representing MACO. And I'm sorry, I did not catch the entirety of your question.
Yeah, so it's also in your letter, Section 23, how do counties transfer, or not counties, pardon, precincts transfer over their data or their election result data?
Oh.
The Mr. Olson.
Yes, I'm sorry, sir.
All right.
Mr. Chair, the electronic...
Does he know his name for the record?
Representative Lee, yes, go ahead.
Yeah. All right, Mr.
Chair. Or Ms. Freeman can answer the question.
Mr. Chair, I'd have to ask my experts that, but it has to do with the modeming in the information versus driving the information. Yeah.
Representative Lee?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So, I mean, I'll read this from the letter. I just thought it was important to note that counties and municipalities that cannot drive over their memory cards use federally and state certified equipment to electronically transmit this. And so the concern here in Section 23 is this section deletes that whole process. And then it gets back to this issue that I know the chair mentioned, this case about destruction of ballots, which already is a felony. And so the point we're trying to make here is just, you know, what happens if you delete this whole provision about allowing electronic transfer, right? Are we going to wait, like, you know, a couple days for these folks to drive down their data?
Mr. Olson.
Mr. Chair, yes, that would cause a delay.
Representative Lee.
That's all I have. I think it's just really important to point out that this bill is really not administrable, and I think most of us here are opposed to the bill, and so we'd like to request a roll call vote on the bill.
Yes, we will have a roll call because we have a member zooming. So thank you, Representative Lee. Mr. Olson, good to see you again. Some of you may not have known that Troy Olson was our Sergeant of Arms many years ago in the House. When I first got elected, what terms did you serve, Troy?
Mr. Chair, I was in the sergeant's office from 2005 to 2013, I believe.
And you were great to work with, Mr. Olson.
Thank you.
Okay, we have one last question. Well, it doesn't have to be, but it's your lead, the non-voting member, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The danger with going last is that most or all of your questions get asked by your members, especially when they're as sharp as the members on my side are. But I guess I do have one question that kind of combines two things together, and I'm wondering if Nicole Freeman would come forward just to answer a question. So we heard a bit about, from Representative Greenman, about the risks, I think, of creating this position of observers and allowing them to take photographs. So on line 14.21, it actually says they can take photographs of ballots being cast. They can observe ballots being cast. Then if you turn to page, and then we talked earlier when under Representative Coulter's questions about the cast vote records. And so if you look on line 17.27, it deletes the carve out for data that includes the date, time, and order in which a voter cast a ballot. So, you know, if you're taking a photograph, it's very easy to include a timestamp on a photograph. So an observer could take a photo, it could be timestamped showing a voter in the booth, even if it's not showing who they vote, you know, if it's not showing a picture of their ballot, it could show this voter fed their ballot into the box at, you know, 2:35 p.m. on Wednesday, March 6th, and the timestamp will be right there. By virtue of removing the carve-out, Ms. Freeman, does that mean you could essentially figure out how every voter voted? Is that a correct statement?
Ms. Freeman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Freiberg. Yeah, I do think that would be a concern, yes, that you could, like you said, take that timed information, and in a lot of these communities, they're smaller, right? It's your neighborhood, your precinct, and so oftentimes folks know each other. Yes, and be able to stitch that back to who the individual was that put the ballot in the tabulator, and then from the cast vote record, what those results were. Yep.
Representative Chair Quam wants to answer that as well.
That would have been if we hadn't undeleted that one line, so therefore the image of the actual ballot would maintain as being non-public, and therefore you would not have the actual vote to be able to reference it to a date stamp. And that's why we made that oral amendment, because you wouldn't have a vision of that. But I do see where you're headed with this, and a clarifying amendment will be present at the next committee to remove the ability to take the picture of a person casting a ballot. In other words, no, you can't take a picture of the voter casting the ballot, and we'll work on the language, because I stand by the law the way it is, that you cannot be photographing a voter voting, but the processes. So I just wanted to clarify.
Thank you, Rep. Quam. Yeah, there were several of us that had a hand in this particular provision and perhaps in the clarification, because the intent, and nor does it say in the language that you can photograph a person's ballot. It's just where ballots are being cast. But it looks like there's some clarifying words and usage that have to be used to accomplish our mission of documenting any wrongful and unlawful activity, which does and has happened, unfortunately, in our nation. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your willingness to work on this. I do think this needs clarification, because I don't think the oral amendment we made addresses that question. It, you know, just that deals with data stored as images, as it relates to cast vote records. So an image of the ballot itself maybe is now can be private, just to get at that handwriting issue. But I, you know, the provision in the bit about observers, I think, kind of contradicts that and does reference specifically votes being cast. So I do have concerns about how those work together. I mean, I guess I'll just sum up our concerns. I appreciate the efforts and the efforts you've made and stated that you're willing to make, Chair Quam, but I'm not sure the statement that you made at the outset that this is a technical bill is entirely accurate. And I can't speak for everybody on the committee on my side, but there are a few things in the bill that certainly I'd be open to, you know, with the caveat that we get stakeholder input. You know, on 2.11, there's a provision that election judges can't vouch for individuals. There's a provision that there has to be a guide provided for the vouching process for residential facilities. That's on 2.31. On line 9.22, there's a requirement that a map and a notice be provided. I mean, you know, some provisions like that, I think there might be the potential to get to consensus on, but there's just, in my mind, too much in here still that's troubling. You know, the provisions related to observers are a little worrisome. You know, I already mentioned just the concern about being able to kind of backfill how each voter voted by the operation of the observer photograph provision with the provision regarding the data on cast vote records. But, you know, there's that additional concern that Representative Greenman mentioned about observers. And, you know, I thought the League of Women Voters submitted a letter here. They said, you know, they talked about observers. They said during the, I'll just read from the letter, I guess. During the 2020 election, numerous videos and photos of election activities and election workers were shared publicly out of context for the situation, with allegations of wrongdoing that were not substantiated. In some cases, this resulted in intimidation, harassment, and threats against local election officials and election workers. Minnesota elections have robust safeguards on conduct in the polling place and provide for rigorous reviews of polling place materials and activities by county election officials. I think there's also that concern related to observers. As Representative Coulter observed, I don't think paper records are sufficient for transmitting vote tabulation. Records should be transmitted electronically and backed up by I think the removing the carve-outs for cast vote records, as we talked about, jeopardizes ballot secrecy. I do, just to be sure, Chair Quam, appreciate your efforts to amend this kind of on the fly to make it better, but there's still a lot of voter privacy concerns present there. As Chair Akam mentioned, making election judges and party affiliation lists public will hurt retention when we already have a shortage. You know, we have letters from the League of Minnesota Cities, the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Minnesota Association of County Officers. For those watching at home, that's the MACO we talk about. It's not a shark. And the League of Women Voters of Minnesota expressing concerns with the bill. So, you know, just a lot of concerns still there. If I had a vote, I don't think I would be supporting. I would not be supporting this at this point. But I do appreciate your willingness to make it better. So that's what I wanted to say.
Rep. Freiberg, Rep. Chair, you'll have the last remarks, but just it seems to be stuck in the video or the observer. You're all aware, you probably watch the news on election night, and the news channels are at the polling place usually taking videos. My newspaper reporter in Delano has photographed both Tom Emmer and I voting. So it'd be no different than that at this point. Just I wanted to get that out. I think Chair Quam mentioned that there's some language that we can clean up a little bit better, but you seem to certainly be stuck in that. There's no intimidation, intent whatsoever. It's strictly telling the news should it be necessary after the polling place is closed. Chair Quam, closing remarks. And then we'll take the vote. Pardon?
Vote yes.
Duly noted that Chair Quam had only just three words to say.
actually two. Vote yes. With that, a roll call being called. Please take the roll call, Ms. Reynolds.
Chair Quam.
Yes.
Vice Chair Altendorf.
Altendorf votes yes.
Representative Akum.
No.
Representative Coulter.
Nope.
Representative Davis.
Aye.
Representative Gordon.
Aye.
Representative Greenman.
No.
Representative Lee.
No.
Representative McDonald.
Aye.
Representative Roach. Aye. Representative Vernig.
No.
Okay, House File 1800 passes. 6 votes yes and 5 nay. Representative Quam renews his motion that House File 1800 pass. Yes, that was the vote. Anyway, votes pass. We will be referring this to public safety. Any other business before this body? Okay, ladies and gentlemen, drive home safely tonight. This meeting is adjourned.